Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, students at St. Stanislaus High School in Mississippi are among the volunteers along U.S. coasts raising oysters to help restore or repair weakened reefs. Oyster reefs are an important part of coastal environments. Each oyster filters or cleans 95 to 190 liters of water a day. Young oysters attach themselves to larger oysters and grow. The reefs provide living space for shrimp, crabs, and fish. They also protect coastlines. In the states of Maryland, Virginia, Mississippi, and Alabama, there are more than 1,000 oyster gardens. Most of them are in wire cages hanging from private ports. Colin Wood is one of two students looking after the St. Stanislaus Garden. He collects data and supervises other students. He said he was excited by the hands-on work he gets to do. "I didn't realize oysters had a big impact on the environment," he said. Dennis Hatfield grows oysters on Little Lagoon in Gulf Shores, Alabama. He said he is surprised each summer by the number of crabs, fish, shrimp, and other animals he clears from his cages. He said that many of the 50,000 to 55,000 adult oysters grown there each year go to reefs in Mobile Bay. In the 1950s, an average of 37,400 tons of oysters were taken yearly from partly salty waters in the U.S. But U.S. oyster harvests fell sharply in the 1990s. Federal data showed the cause of the drop to be over-harvesting, pollution, pests, and other problems. Commercial farmers around the country grow oysters near the surface of water. Oysters develop much faster where the water holds more of the plankton they eat and predators can be more easily removed. Oyster gardening uses many of the same methods as farming, but the oysters are not being grown to be eaten. Oyster gardens get pulled from the water every 7 to 10 days. The time out of the water is used to clear out small animals, keep oysters from growing through the wires, and dry and clean off plant life growing on the wires. Bob Stokes is director of the Galveston Bay Foundation in Texas. He said oyster gardening is as much about education as it is restoration. Oyster gardening started in the late 1990s around the Chesapeake Bay, where harvests had dropped 90% in 20 years. The Mississippi-Alabama Sea Grants oyster gardening program was modeled after the Chesapeake's. The Chesapeake Bay oysters faced many problems, including two deadly diseases. Chris Moore is a scientist with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. He said decreases in oyster numbers in the second half of the 1900s followed a more severe decrease in the 1920s from widespread over-harvesting. Gardeners in the foundation and its member groups have added at least 15 million oysters in Maryland and 1 million in Virginia, Moore said. Another group called the Chesapeake Oyster Alliance has set a goal of adding 10 billion oysters by 2025.
The United States Supreme Court's decision last week to leave in place a Texas law banning most abortions gives states a chance to restrict other rights, including gun ownership. To do that, states could pass laws copying the Texas law's enforcement procedure. It is unclear how many states will actually do so. The Republican-supported Texas law takes enforcement away from state officials. That way, the law avoids judicial review. Instead, the law permits private citizens to sue anyone who performs or assists a woman in getting an abortion after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. The law awards $10,000 to citizens for successful lawsuits. The Texas law was designed to be difficult for courts to block because it removed state officials from enforcement. That makes it hard to know who to sue and get a ruling that would end it statewide. The Supreme Court largely accepted the enforcement structure. But the court is permitting abortion providers to continue with a legal challenge aimed at some medical licensing officials. The Center for Reproductive Rights is a legal group in favor of abortion rights. It says legislators in five other Republican-led states have introduced abortion bills modeled on the Texas law, but none have yet been passed. Critics have said that ruling would allow states to pass laws that avoid other recognized rights, like gay and religious rights, as well as guns. The day after the Supreme Court decision, California Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, began to work on a bill to limit gun use. It would also permit private citizens to sue anyone who builds, distributes, or sells assault weapons or self-built ghost guns. Citizens would also be awarded at least $10,000 in damages. In Illinois, one Democratic legislator has proposed targeting gun dealers with a measure similar to the one California is considering. New York Attorney General Letitia James, another Democrat, said on television Tuesday that she would support a similar effort in her state. Stacy Radner is a spokesperson for the gun control group Everytown for Gun Safety. She said in a statement that California's bill is an interesting approach that we're going to examine further as we get more details. The Supreme Court is not preventing laws that infringe constitutionally protected rights. I do think this is a bit of an invitation to other states, said David Knoll. He is a professor at Rutgers Law School in New Jersey. James White is a Republican member of the Texas House of Representatives who supports the state's abortion law. He questioned in a letter to the state's attorney general whether private individuals must follow the Supreme Court's 2015 ruling legalizing gay marriage. But White told Reuters he does not expect a state law similar to the abortion law targeting the rights of same-sex relationships. Shannon Minter is with the National Center for Lesbian Rights. She said that any such measure would be discriminatory and illegal. But she said that she has not yet heard of any such proposal. I have not, and I hope I never do, Minter said. I'm Dan Novak.
The American Space Agency, NASA, is preparing to launch a new telescope designed to explore parts of space never observed before. The James Webb Space Telescope enters a new launch window on December 24th. The mission has already been delayed many times in recent years. The telescope is named after NASA's second administrator, who led the agency from 1961 to 1968. The orbiting observatory is set to launch on an Ariane 5 rocket from French Guiana in South America. The mission is a joint project between NASA, the European Space Agency, and the Canadian Space Agency. The James Webb is considered NASA's new generation telescope after the Hubble and Spitzer Space Telescopes. Hubble was launched more than 30 years ago, and Spitzer was deployed in 2003. Both of those telescopes led to numerous discoveries and provided more detailed, colorful space images than ever before. But NASA says the James Webb is the largest and most powerful space science telescope ever built. It is meant to build on the discoveries of the other telescopes while gathering more in-depth data on the early development of the universe. The James Webb is a large infrared telescope with a nearly 7-meter mirror for exploring space. Infrared waves are a kind of electromagnetic energy that cannot be seen with the human eye, but they exist at a wavelength that is good for observing distant objects through gas and dust in space. The whole telescope is designed to collapse inside the launch vehicle and open back up in space. The telescope's mirror and scientific instruments are protected by a thick sun shield. When fully open, the shield is about the size of a tennis court. The James Webb will travel to an orbit about 1.6 kilometers away from Earth. It will then complete a 6-month commissioning period in space. It is during this time that the telescope will open its mirror, sun shield, and other small systems. NASA engineers say this period will be the most difficult for the telescope. This is because of its massive size, the complex opening method, and the extremely cold temperatures in space. Eric Smith is the telescope's program director and a program scientist. "I like to think of the telescope as NASA's vehicle for the deepest space exploration that humanity can do," he told the Associated Press. "It will allow us to see farther back in time, to the time when the very first stars and galaxies were being born." Smith added that the telescope's infrared abilities will also permit it to peer through clouds of gas and dust in our own galaxy, where stars and planets are being born today. NASA says the telescope aims to help scientists learn about all periods of the universe's history dating back to just after the Big Bang event about 13.8 billion years ago. It is also designed to study exoplanets, planets that orbit stars other than the Sun. John Mather is a project scientist for the mission at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. We're going to look at everything there is in the universe that we can see, he told Reuters news agency. We want to know, how did we get here from the Big Bang? How did that work? So we'll look. Klaus Pontoppidan is a project scientist at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. He says the James Webb is powerful enough to uncover the unexpected. We can plan what we think we're going to see, he said, adding, but at the end of the day, we know that nature will surprise us more often than not. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1880, President Rutherford Hayes completed four successful years in the White House. He did not want to serve another term. Hayes was a Republican. His party had great hopes of electing another Republican in the election of 1880. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe report on that election.
Many Republicans wanted to nominate former President Ulysses Grant. Grant had been out of office 4 years. People seemed to have forgotten the political problems that shook his administration. Other Republicans supported the powerful party leader, Senator James Blaine. A third candidate was John Sherman, the Secretary of the Treasury. The Republicans had great difficulty choosing among Grant, Blaine, and Sherman. At their national convention, Republican delegates voted again and again. None of the three men received a majority.
The delegates voted 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. Finally, on the 34th ballot, 17 of the delegates voted for a compromised candidate. He was James Garfield, a Republican leader in Congress. Soon, both Sherman and Blaine asked all of their delegates to vote for Garfield. The compromise candidate won the nomination. James Garfield offered the vice presidential nomination to Chester Arthur of New York. Arthur's honesty had been questioned when President Hayes removed him as collector of taxes for the port of New York. But a powerful party leader there supported him. So delegates gave Arthur the vice presidential nomination to strengthen party unity.
The Democratic Party chose for its presidential candidate a hero of the Civil War, General Winfield Scott Hancock of Pennsylvania. The election campaign of 1880 was not exciting. Democrats charged that Republicans were dishonest. Republicans charged that a Democrat in the White House would make the South too powerful. Many people at that time still hated the South for starting the Civil War. They wanted to keep Southern states weak. 9 million people voted in the election. James Garfield won. He got only 10,000 more popular votes than Winfield Scott Hancock, but he got a majority of votes in the Electoral College. Garfield won 214 electoral votes. Hancock got 155.
The new president was 49 years old. He had served in the House of Representatives for 17 years. He had been a teacher, a college president, and a general in the Union Army during the Civil War. James Garfield became president of the United States on March 4th, 1881. His choices for a cabinet immediately reopened the conflicts that had appeared during the party convention.
The Republican Party had two powerful leaders. One was Senator Roscoe Conkling. The other was Senator James Blaine. Garfield won Blaine's support by naming him Secretary of State. He lost Conkling's support by refusing to name one of Conkling's supporters Secretary of the Treasury. Garfield denied he had promised anything to Conkling. Then he made Conkling even angrier by appointing one of Conkling's political enemies collector of taxes for the Port of New York. That was the most important federal job in Conkling's home state. Conkling refused to accept the appointment. He began a struggle in the Senate to block it.
Conkling charged that President Garfield had failed to observe the policy of senatorial courtesy. Traditionally, the president does not fill federal jobs in a state until he discusses them with the senators from that state. This long-time policy gave senators firm control over local federal jobs. They were quick to attack any changes in the method. But many senators were angry at Conkling. They did not like the way he gave orders to everyone. They did not like the way he threatened his opponents. They did not want to support him on this issue.
After several weeks, it became clear that the Senate would approve President Garfield's choice for the tax collector's job. Conkling decided to resign in protest. He would ask the New York legislature to show its support by electing him again to the Senate. Before this could happen, something very unexpected took place. It happened in the train station in Washington, D.C. on July 2nd, 1881. A man ran up to President Garfield, pulled out a gun, and fired twice. One bullet cut Garfield's arm. The other went into his back.
The assassin was Charles Guiteau. When he fired the gun, he shouted that he supported Roscoe Conkling's political machine. Charles Guiteau was insane. He believed God had ordered him to kill the president. But the words he shouted caused many people to wonder if others might be involved. After all, the vice president, Chester Arthur, supported Roscoe Conkling too. If James Garfield died, Chester Arthur would become president. History has provided no evidence that Roscoe Conkling, Chester Arthur, or any other political leader had a part in the shooting. Guiteau is believed to have acted on his own. Yet the situation did cause a great deal of tension while the nation waited to see if Garfield would survive.
The president was carried to the White House. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from his back. He could not find it. Days passed. The president's condition changed from day to day. Doctors pushed their instruments into the wound as they continued to look for the bullet. The wound became infected. Garfield grew worse. Then he grew better. He asked to be taken to the seashore. 2 months later, the doctors warned the cabinet and Vice President Arthur that Garfield was dying. The end finally came on September 19, 1881. The president's body was taken back to Washington. Memorial services were held there. And then the body was taken to his home state of Ohio for burial.
Not until after Garfield's death did doctors find the bullet that killed him. It lay only a few centimeters from the wound. Tissue had grown around it. The bullet itself would not have killed the president. What killed him was the effort made by doctors to find the bullet. Their instruments had spread infection throughout his body. James Garfield had been president for 6 months. He was the second American president to be assassinated. The first, Abraham Lincoln, had been shot just 16 years before.
The man who shot James Garfield, Charles Guiteau, was tried by a court in Washington. He was found guilty of murder. Like those found guilty of plotting to kill Abraham Lincoln, he was hanged. Vice President Chester Arthur was in New York when he received news of President Garfield's death. He quickly sent for a judge to give him the oath of office as president. Arthur was in his early 50s. He would serve one term as leader of the United States.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.